Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another episode of the Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is author Eric Wentz. Eric has just published his second novel, and it's a cracker. Killing Sharks, De Profundis. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Simon. It's good to be back with you. It's been a few years.
Right. And I have taken that time to build up lots of questions for you. But, you know, before I start my third degree interrogation and waterboard you, why don't you share with our listeners a little bit about yourself? Who is Eric Wentz?
Okay, well, first of all, I should tell you that I'm a lifelong learner in the sense that I truly enjoy reading myself. I enjoy reading the works of other authors, but long before that ever started, I was one of those kids in grade school who didn't particularly like school. And I found that the only activity that I really enjoyed, other than recess, was reading. And I could do it on my own. I didn't need a school. I didn't need a teacher as far as I was concerned. And as a result, I have the distinction of telling you that when I was in the fifth grade, I missed 90 out of 180 days of school, and God punished me. Today, I am therefore a teacher of English literature.
I think you deserve that punishment.
Well, thank you. What I did to my teachers and my students now do to me. And at this point in my career, I am teaching high school. As I say, I teach English literature. And in addition to that, as you know, I spent a total of almost three decades affiliated with the United States Navy, and prior to that, time with the U.S. Army. So it's been a long and somewhat convoluted career whereby eventually I turned to writing.
Okay, I have to ask you this. It's completely, you know, off script. Not that I actually ever use a script. I love reading. I hated English literature. Yeah, I grew up, went through the English grammar school system, and I had this set to with an English lit teacher. He said, you know, class, good news. You know, the next book we're going to read and analyze is George Orwell's 1984. I groaned, and he heard it, and he said, Mr. Barrett, what is the issue? And I said, I've already read the book. Yeah, it's kind of boring. Couldn't we find something more interesting?
Well, Simon, I can only tell you that my experiences were somewhat similar at times, but by and large, I found, even as a kid, I found certain types of action-adventure stories really appealing. When I was in grade school, I used to read, if not the books that we had in class, I would read classic comic books. And I hesitate to say this, but I fell in love with literature in part because classic comic books told such great stories like Moby Dick, The Scarlet Letter. And, of course, I was reading an abridged version that had lots of pictures. And I read them. I devoured them. I remember at one point I had over 150 comic books, and they were stories that I would later end up teaching to high school and college students.
Okay, I think I already know the answer to this next question, but I'll ask it anyway. What made you decide to become a writer?
Well, I had always enjoyed a certain amount of writing, even on my own. And I would write poetry in grade school. And let me give you an illustration. My poetry had a certain utility to it, at least I thought it did. When I was in grade school, I had a favorite baseball player who was from the same town in Pennsylvania that I'm from. I'm from New Eagle, Pennsylvania, which is right next to a little town called Denora. And Denora had a legendary baseball player that went that was born there. You may have heard of him. His name is Stan Musial. And Stan Musial is a player that is the same caliber as Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams. And because he was a local hometown favorite, and because I knew who he was, I grew up hearing the name, and because my relatives all knew him, and he used to spend time there as a boy, when I was in the eighth grade, I wrote him a poem. And to my delight, a couple of weeks later, he sent me back an 8x10 glossy of himself that he autographed. At that point, I guess I realized that I could convert my poetic skill, if you will, into something that would get me what I wanted. And not long after that, I entered a contest, and the contest was this. In 25 words or less, what would you tell the people behind the Iron Curtain about the United States? Well, I was one of the winners. And so my commentary and my voice was actually broadcast over Radio Free Europe behind the Iron Curtain. And then all the way through high school, I enjoyed Latin and the other studies of language, and I still do. And so at a certain point, I think I took a natural affinity for love of language, and I simply began applying it most generally in academic settings. For example, I have a bachelor's degree, two master's, and a doctorate. So obviously, I was writing a lot academically. But then I realized what I read for enjoyment was a kind of action-adventure literature, a lot of historic romances. And as a kid, for example, I devoured the Waverly Tales by Sir Walter Scott. I loved the stories of Robin Hood and Athelstane and Rebecca and Rowena and all those characters that have eventually been turned into film icons, so to speak. I loved all of that. And so eventually, I think that I realized one day I want to write a story like that. But I also recognize the fact that stories that have a historic significance resonate with me. And good fiction is, in my opinion, as worthwhile, if not more worthwhile at times, than so-called factual literature. In fact, I would suggest that fiction gives the writer a greater degree of opportunity to write the truth about a situation than even so-called journalistic accounts sometimes provide.
Right.
So anyway,
and actually, that was a question I had on my list for you. You know, I agree with you. You know, you can often use fiction as a way to get facts across without crossing any boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I would add to this that my second book in particular is of such a nature that I could not have written it in a purely factual manner and still have gotten it published. Because of issues associated with my time in the military, I had to do certain things to obscure, if you will, real people and real situations. Otherwise, I would not have been able to get permission to publish the book.
Can we come back to that discussion? Because
sure.
You know, there is something I really, really want to ask you about that particular subject. I greatly enjoyed your first book, Piercing the Veil, and you have eclipsed that with Killing Sharks. Without giving any spoilers, because I hate that. Yeah,
sure.
Can you share the basic plot line?
Well, let's start with the title, okay? You want to stay away from the title for a minute?
Yeah, let's just talk about the plot.
Okay, the plot in so many words is that I've taken the character, who is a U.S. Navy SEAL, highly trained, and linguistically very capable, which is not at all uncommon among people that are in the top echelon of our special forces. And that's true not just of the SEALs, it's also true, for example, of our Green Beret and our Delta Force individuals. A lot of them are people that are bright in a number of disciplines, not merely devotees of military skills, but people that can speak other languages, people that have devotion to their weaponry, their craft, and so forth. But this character is a person who has those aptitudes with language, with the martial arts, so to speak. And he is confronted by a situation whereby he has to leave his immediate assignment in Afghanistan. He finds himself going face-to-face with members of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, interestingly enough, at Guantanamo. And it's a situation in which his encounter leads him through the interviewing process or interrogation, leads him to believe that there is a detainee at Guantanamo who can provide information and will provide information only to a person that he trusts, which in this case happens to be Lieutenant Commander Grant Chisholm. And much of the story is an explanation not only of their immediate confrontations, but the aftermath of that and, if you will, the surrounding attributes of the global war on terror and how it affects not just Guantanamo, but so many of us throughout the world that have actually encountered these guys, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, firsthand, up front, and close and personal, as they used to like to say on Wide World of Sports.
I have an observation, and I'd love to hear your comments. The more I read, the more convinced I become that some authors like yourself, use the genre of fiction to reflect fact, but for various reasons, usually of a legal nature, they cannot. Last week I talked with Damian Lewis. His latest book is the number one bestseller in the UK. But it's mostly factual, and the only way he could get it published was to change names and certain specific situations. Otherwise, the Department of Defense would have shut the book down. I'm now reading a book about missing nukes as a result of the collapse in the USSR. The book is titled as fiction, but guess what? The author was indeed part of the international team tasked with accounting for where the nukes went. Now, both books give me pause for thought. And I'm beginning to guess that killing sharks falls into that same category.
Well, Simon, it does. And again, I run into the same issue. There are certain things that I'm not at liberty to say or discuss. But I would suggest that the authors that you just mentioned, as well as myself, also fall into the realm of those who are, in a sense, providing you with a what-if scenario. And frankly, that's what the military has spent billions of dollars trying to consider. What if this were to happen, and how would we respond? And I think there's, once again, I'm going to use the word utility. There's a certain utility to that kind of literature. it suggests to you, if this happens, then maybe we need to do this. At the same time, you don't want to give away, for example, technological information or the names of people actually involved in enterprises that would consider such things as this, because you don't want to jeopardize their safety. You don't want to jeopardize your own clearance. At the same time, you do recognize a need, if you will, to promote the understanding of certain things that, by and large, I would say the public is not necessarily aware of, but you think maybe they should be aware of. And without going into details, I would like to think that some of the things that I did divulge, most particularly things I said about Guantanamo, will help put it in a perspective that, frankly, is going to fly in the face of some of the information provided by the so-called mainstream media, which oftentimes is, I would accuse it of committing the sin of omission. And by that is they don't always provide the whole story. And sometimes I think it's because they simply look where the light is brightest, and they look there, not necessarily where the artifacts of truth can be found. And sometimes they're in dark places.
Oh, I'm in total agreement with you. But I think the point I'm trying to hammer home, and I don't think you're going to have an argument with me over this, is that you can find lots of facts by reading fiction. And, you know, most people don't like history books. They want an action-adventure book. And, you know, letting people, you know, have access to an action-adventure book, you're actually teaching them something.
Well, I'd like to think that we can do that without being inordinately didactic. And I think you've said the magic words there. A lot of people like action-adventure, but they say they don't like history. I think, for example, people don't like to read books necessarily pertaining to how policy was formed. They might like to see the interaction of personalities forming the policy, but I don't think too many people enjoy reading policy manuals, even if they're associated with things such as how a military operation is to be carried out. They'd much rather see it carried out and see the personalities even in conflict than, again, to have someone say, well, this is the strategy, these are the tactics that would typically be employed, and this is the text that will teach you how to do that. So, yeah, I agree that we can teach something through works of fiction, and I would even add this, that a lot of works of fiction do not necessarily contradict the facts. They merely infer, or they merely add information that connects the facts. So much so that you would even say of those works, they don't necessarily contradict the facts, but a person reading this material will say, well, I don't know if this is true or not, but I know these other things are true. And so this seems to be a feasible scenario as to how we got from this fact to that fact. And that's where you find, for example, that we even inject dialogue about real meetings that take place between people, even if we may not have been in the room when those conversations occurred.
Yeah, I'm in total agreement with you. And yeah, when I read Killing Sharks, I thought to myself, it's a great book, and I bet, you know, it falls into my new category, you know, of fiction that has its legs in fact, you know. And yeah, obviously there are aspects of the book that I don't think are true, but
well, I'll simply make a comment that I'm going to quote one of my reviewers. One of the people that read the book before I released it said, "This is fact posing as fiction." In some ways, that comment is true. But again, I can't take too many liberties with it, and I don't want to jeopardize anybody else who works for us in the U.S. military, so I'm certainly not going to divulge anything that would be of assistance to the enemy, which in this case is Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Right, and I would be really disappointed if you were to do so.
Well, Simon and I have two adult children that are in the U.S. Army, so they mean a lot to me, and that, therefore that's something I'm not going to, I would never do.
We're going to get off this subject, you know, before we dig ourselves a large hole.
Okay. All right.
Much of the action in killing sharks happens in Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay. I understand that you've been there. Oh, not as a vacationing guest.
I hope never to go in that capacity.
Right. Is Gitmo as you portray it? You know, it's a small city that, you know, has a life of its own with a McDonald's.
Sure. In fact, just a fact of historic fact is that this is the oldest U.S. Navy base outside the United States, and that goes back to the Spanish-American War. We fought a battle there against the Spanish, and this is what led eventually to Cuban independence. But part of the deal was thereafter we would have Guantanamo as a U.S. Navy base, and even if you didn't have the prison camp down there, you have as many, typically about 7,000 U.S. military personnel and their families stationed there. So, yeah, there's a McDonald's, there's a Starbucks, there are a number of other things. Now, I'm not going to tell you that it's luxurious by any stretch of the imagination, but you do have some of the amenities that we associate with living in the United States, and it's part of the means by which you attract good people so that they'll want to stay in the military, because otherwise you're pretty much confined at Guantanamo. You have a 17-mile fence line with Cuba proper, and you dare not go over that line into mainland Cuba lest you be arrested by the communist forces.
I'm amazed. You know, most people think of Gitmo as, you know, this small area, you know, maybe there's a couple of hundred people, a bunch of prisoners, and that's it. But obviously it's much larger than that.
Well, yes, it is. In fact, I think the landmass area, it's about 45 square miles altogether, and that includes the harbor itself. In other words, we're taking into account the water area of Guantanamo as well. And, of course, it's right there on the ocean. And if there were no prison camp, we would still have Guantanamo. And also, and this is where I think a lot of Americans in particular, and Europeans as well, get the impression that it's just a prison camp. Obviously, that's where the focus is. And if it weren't for the prison camp, Guantanamo would be shrouded in obscurity for most people even today. And so you know, you have the focus on the prison camp, and that's about all that people see. The rest of it is simply not, and I'm going to quote a newspaper, or I'm going to quote a news anchorman, who once said, "There's nothing sexy here." And he was referring to the rest of the base.
I like it. Okay. Let's go back to the title of the book. For My Sins, as Child, I went through the English grammar school system, and my punishment included 4 years of learning Latin. My mother one day asked me if I was planning on, you know, vacationing, Yeah. And I,
really?
Yeah. Okay. I said, no, mother, it's dead language.
But,
it seemed pointless at the time, you know, learning Latin, but I found value in it over the years. When I have time, which is not very often, you know, I love to play with crossword puzzles. So I found that Latin gives you a great grounding in vocabulary and discovering words. But, yeah, that's got nothing to do with it. The title of your book includes De Profundis, which can be taken in several ways.
Sure.
I rather like the definition out of the depths. My inquiring mind asks, why would you include Latin in your title? And do I have that definition correct?
Well, let's start with why would I include that in the title? That's the same question the editor asked. At one point, that was the title. And the alternative title was Killing Sharks. And then one editor simply said to me, he said, look, do you want to sell books or don't you? And the comment had to do with the fact that De Profundis might turn people off, at least that was the thinking, because they wouldn't know what it meant. And so we went with Killing Sharks, which, as I say, was the alternative. And De Profundis, of course, means literally, as you suggest, out of the depths. And given that we're talking about a U.S. Navy SEAL, who, and much of the story takes place underwater, I thought it was an appropriate title, but it's also a double entendre. And by that I mean it's also the battle cry of the Knights of Santiago that fought the Moors of Spain in the Middle Ages. And, of course, it comes from the psalm. If we translate it from English back into Latin, it literally is, again, De Profundis, or out of the depths of my soul I call to you, O Lord. And since it was the battle cry of the Knights of Santiago, or St. James, fighting the Moors, I thought in some ways the culture clash between at least parts of the Islamic world and the West in some ways was being recreated in our own lifetime. And so I thought it had an application that would reconnect us to an ancient past in which we see that the conflict between Islam and the West, although it isn't necessarily a foregone conclusion or isn't imminent each and every century, it does have a long history in which we've played out against one another. So I thought the title was apropos in several ways. And I should add, well, go ahead.
No, carry on.
Okay, and the other thing is the title Killing Sharks. Yeah, as someone who studied grammar, you'll appreciate this, I think. Again, it's a double entendre. And it has to do with, literally, it can mean someone who kills sharks, but it can also mean sharks that kill. And both terms are applicable, once again, in this book. And if you read the foreword, that is the first couple of pages of the book, where I've got an inscription or two, you'll see that I've translated some of this material, and I've also given you the origin of the word shark and its connection with a major tribe in ancient Arabia. And again, I thought it was all entirely apropos.
Oh, I think you did a wonderful job. I looked at it and I giggled. It was a question I wanted to ask you, because I'm not sure everyone has studied Latin.
Sure.
So let's do some shameless commercialization. You're up for that, I'm sure.
Okay, you bet I am.
Right. Where can people buy copies of Killing Sharks?
Okay, well, right now, the electronic versions are available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and they can purchase it directly from the publisher, Tate Publishing, T-A-T-E, TatePublishing.com. The official release date is actually May 28th.
We're doing this before it's happened?
Well, we're doing it before it's actually in the bookstores.
And again, I
have a book signing coming up next week, and we have 200 copies already just for that book signing. So I assure you that the publisher is more than happy to get them out. But they're now in the process of distributing them to the warehouses, and so that Amazon and Barnes & Noble can actually have them in their bookstores, for example. But right now, the electronic versions are out first. May 28th will be going, I hope, nationwide, and my understanding is we'll be advertising on television as well at that point.
My goodness. Wow. It's rarely I talk to an author that, that says, and it will be on TV.
Well, this is, for me at least, I think this is a major step. And I'm hoping that it is, in fact, indicative of the fact people think that the book has the quality. And, if you take a look at the one of the reviewers, it's the Undersecretary of Defense. And if anybody knows the military, he certainly does. And I'm happy to say that he compared my work to Tom Clancy, Dan Brown, and also to Graham Greene. And if I can be so bold as to make a suggestion, if my book is indeed comparable to the works of a Graham Greene, then that would suggest that maybe I've done something a little bit different in this action-adventure thriller than is customarily done by the others that write adventure stories.
You are exactly correct. You have done something different. Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, I read the book and I said, Simon, I know this isn't entirely fiction.
Yeah.
it gave me pause to think. On a more philosophical level, I have a question for you.
Sure.
In my mind, prior to 9/11, we regular folks had never paid much attention to terrorists. Sure, we'd heard about the Baader-Meinhof gang. We'd heard of Timothy McVeigh. We'd heard of Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. But largely, we were disconnected. These events didn't affect us. But 9/11 did. Changes have been made in border security. Yeah, it's way tighter. If you want to take a flight, you got to deal with metal detectors, drug sniffing dogs. Take your shoes off. Full body scans, pat downs. Is this the right direction that we need to take?
Well, I want to go back to your original supposition there. That is that Americans were largely, if you will, asleep prior to 9/11. And I would agree with you that the public at large just didn't know that much about it. However, before I go to the second part of your comment, I would simply make the observation that much of the world was continuously confronting terrorism in ways that were Americans saw it on television, but I don't think it struck us in the heart because it wasn't us. And I'll even use England as an example. In England, you've had to deal with the Irish Republican Army for a number of years. And let's face it, those were bloody, bloody instances of people that were simply casual bystanders being blown up by bombs. You had soldiers being killed that ostensibly were there at certain times. You could even say to protect the people that subsequently attacked them. And if you took a look at what happened, not just with the Meinhof gang and some of the others, there had been instances, particularly in the Middle East, in Ceylon or Sri Lanka, where you had terrorist activities that were unduly brutal. And, I mean, the assassinating of school children and others just to send a message to parents. And, of course, much of Central Africa suffered those kind of maladies throughout the 70s and the 80s and even the 90s. So I think that, yeah, for most Americans, it was something that only happened over there. And I guess we could even take comfort in the fact that we say, yes, and the people that did attack us on 9/11, they were not of us. They were against us, but they're not part of our own a population. Now, your whole question about is this the right direction? I do think it's the right direction in some ways. However, I think there's a missing element to it. And that element is something that I, for years, I've always thought we've been remiss in this. There are people that picked up hints of this even before it happened that were largely ignored. And let me tell you why I think we get ignored, even if we say, look, there's a threat here, it's impending. And I'm going to use not 9/11 as an example. Instead, I'm going to use the hostage situation in Iran when Ayatollah Khomeini took over as an example. You know, there are people that sat in coffee shops in Tehran listening in on conversations by students, the young Ahmadinejads and so forth, and they heard them planning to attack the U.S. embassy. And how did they know they were doing it? Because they were people who spoke another language. They were Westerners, and they were Canadian, among other things. And they tried to warn us, but because we could not come up with corroborating statements from our own personnel, because nobody at the U.S. embassy spoke Farsi except one U.S. Marine out of over 200 people. At a certain point, I would say that we are still woefully remiss in this regard. We think that our technology, as in the body scans and everything else at the airports, will save us. They will help us, but they will not save us. We still do not speak the languages of much of the rest of the world. We are still woefully remiss when it comes to training languages and valuing those people who speak them, whether it's Arabic or Farsi, or imagine whatever else it could be, Chinese, who knows, or Uzbek. And to this day, I still think we don't get it. And I'm not sure that we will until the next instance occurs whereby we say, why didn't we translate the message? And I'm going to give you one quick example. 20% of all the people released from Guantanamo go back to jihadist activities. And so your question might be, why do we release them? Because the information that would condemn them or keep them locked up indefinitely, oftentimes we don't have that information translated until a year or two after we release the people. That's because we don't have enough quality translators who are going through stacks of material that we have taken out of places in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere that helps us, as they say, connect the dots.
Right. That was splendid. I've been, broadcasting for something like 4 years. That was one of the finest rants I've ever heard.
Well, I like the word finest. I don't know about rant, but okay.
I think that you have it absolutely correct. We do make mistakes, and we need to stop making those mistakes. My wife's brother's son is heading off to Afghanistan, I believe, next week. And Sunday. why are we still engaged? Why can't we just use, you know, drones? And, you know, you can take all the pictures you want. You can blow everyone up that you want. You know, you're keeping people out of harm's way.
Well, I would agree that the drones are helpful. But the drones cannot interpret for you the heart of a person. You cannot interpret the intent of a person merely with the drone. And while your drone is taking pictures, there may be someone who is quite literally out of sight, out of mind, who is planning something else. And you'll never get the gist of that plan unless you've got somebody on the ground. And that somebody on the ground should be someone who understands the culture and the language. And if I can apply it even to the news media, one of the things that I think is reprehensible about the contemporary news media in the United States is increasingly I see, and I've watched it happen, I've watched news programs in which they get, and these are major networks, they get the president's name of a country wrong. They get the leader of a tribal faction wrong. And you go, how do they do that? They do that because they no longer have bureau chiefs that filter the news, that understand the language, that live there year-round. Instead, you have what some people now refer to as the CNN phenomenon, whereby they parachute their journalist into the hot spot, who then has his picture taken, surrounded by bodies or whatever it happens to be the catch of the day for the international news media. But it's a person who doesn't understand the language, therefore can't even make intelligent guesses about who this is and who did this or who did that, because he's culturally unaware. And I think that we are, as again, as a nation, as remiss in this area as anybody.
Right. Okay, how do we fix it?
I think that starts at the top. And by that I mean if we had a president, if we had a Congress, and they simply took that information to DOD and the State Department and said, look, you don't have enough people that speak the language, and just because you have political connections doesn't mean that you should be the person in charge over here. And our language schools are among the finest in the world. We just don't use them enough. And we don't exploit the talent we have here in America because, well, you know, there's a scene in the Mutiny on the Bounty that I love, and I use it with my own students. There's a scene in which the members of the bounty crew are trying to talk with some South Sea Islanders, and obviously they don't understand each other. And then finally one of the crew members simply says this. He said, there's nobody in the world that can't understand English if you speak it loud enough and slowly enough. Unfortunately, Simon, I still think we suffer from that perspective.
Right. I mean, that's a classic line. I love it. You know, I've heard the quote, I don't know how many times, you know, if you speak slowly and loud, you'll get your message across.
Yeah, and I think we're sometime that's where we are.
So, yeah, you have found a niche, and you are a genuinely skillful writer. What have you got next up your sleeve?
Well, when I started this adventure in writing, I thought that I would write a book. And as I wrote, I realized that I couldn't get everything in one book. So I finally concluded Piercing the Veil. And then 3 years later, I started looking for a publisher for the book that we're now talking about, Killing Sharks. Well, as I wrote Killing Sharks, I realized this isn't going to end it either. So at the very least, I now anticipate two more books associated with this protagonist, the U.S. Navy SEAL, Lieutenant Commander Grant Chisholm. And I'm hoping that it excites interest. I hope that people find that the connections are there. But at the same time, I want each volume to stand by itself so that you can pick up what will eventually be volume 3 or volume 4, enjoy it, And then if you enjoy it enough, I hope you'll go back and read the other books as well.
Right. So, you know, even though your protagonist stays the same, you can pick up any of the books and get enjoyment. You don't really need to have read the other books.
At least that's what I anticipate. And people that have read Killing Sharks already tell me that they enjoyed the book, and so much so that they're now going to go out and buy Piercing the Veil. So I know they didn't read the first book, and that's fine. The fact that they thought that this book was good enough tells me that, the books are, I think, standalone quality.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about Piercing the Veil. Give us the thumbnail sketch. What is the story?
Well, we're back to Latin, so you're going to have to ask me that question again about the title in just a minute here. Okay. Yeah, I can't help it. I have that background, too. Piercing the Veil begins during World War II at the inception of the British Special Forces, what in effect becomes the SAS, and its eventual evolution into almost a contiguous relationship with the evolution of American Special Forces, out of which eventually comes the OSS, and from that, of course, the CIA. And the story goes back from World War II to a young lieutenant commander, at that point, lieutenant commander, and his quest to find out, in part, why his own grandfather, who was one of the original Special Forces individuals, how he disappeared after World War II. And from that point on, we end up traveling all over the globe, and much of that story, as you may recall, takes place in Africa. And eventually, it forces us to confront an issue that is still very much with us, not only a kind of religious fundamentalism that is given to destruction of those that do not share the same views, but also a perspective on things such as the blood diamond trafficking that still goes on today, as well as the ethno-religious conflicts. There are still so much of Kenya, Uganda, and Somalia, and Chad, for example, even right now as we speak.
Yes, I'm in total agreement. You know, it's a disaster zone. But should we intervene, or should we keep hands off and let these disasters, run their course naturally?
I don't think there's any one answer that I or anybody else could give to that. And I think that this is one of the dilemmas that we as human beings face. And let me give you a simple example, because I did mention Somalia. If you go back to the Bush administration, not this Bush, but George Bush the Elder, and after Ronald Reagan left office, and Ronald Reagan was very much a proponent of American power and might abroad, and hence he did rebuild our military. But you may recall that we had an issue in Somalia, specifically Mogadishu, and it had to do with the fact that we were sending over vast quantities of food because the estimates were as many as 2 million were in the process of starving to death. We couldn't get the food off the docks, because the warlords wouldn't allow it. They were actually taking the food, confiscating it, and using it as a means of buying influence with the various tribes and the other people. And they were also making sure that certain people that weren't on their side were not allowed to have access to the food, and hence that would force their starvation. I still remember what George Bush said when he was asked for justification for sending people in to Somalia, U.S. military personnel. George Bush's comment was simple. He said, look at the children. And I have to admit that when you looked at the starving children, you did want to help. But you also had to recognize the fact that in order to help, we were going to have to send in the military, and in effect, we were going to have to break some heads. And we did. But as the incident as portrayed in Black Hawk Down, that incident also cost the lives of a number of U.S. soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is a dilemma. And again, there's no one answer to anything that you've just asked there. And sometimes I wish there were.
You know, I just like to ask questions that I know there are no answers to. Yeah, it's an evil trait that I have.
I get it.
I'm looking at the clock. I have to wind this up. Eric, it has been great to talk to you. And, you know, I would love to sit down across the table with you, have a bunch of your students, and we could have a good debate on virtually any subject.
Well, you know, Simon, that is something we could actually do sometime. And as I say, next week I have a presentation and a subsequent book signing. And I'm in a location that I think people would be delighted to do something like that. So we need to stay in touch. And I think that we could actually orchestrate what you've just suggested.
Right. Yeah, I can play bad cop. You can play good cop. Nah, it doesn't work quite as simply as that. Yeah. The point is, so few people really understand what's going on. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you're talking about Somalia, Guantanamo Bay, or Israel, Syria. You know, people just see this glossy thing on the news that they don't understand the backstory. And without the backstory, you got nothing.
I agree with you, and I think it's one of the difficulties. As more and more people get their news straight from the visuals, if you will, rather than actual reading, I think that we subject ourselves to being more easily led rather than actually asking the questions that will enable us as a people, as a nation, to ask the right questions, first of all, and then to intelligently assess what are the options that we, for example, in foreign policy and in issues dealing with terrorism, what the answers are to the questions that we should be posing. And I think that's difficult. And as a teacher, I speak to that every day. I want my students to be well-read. They don't have to agree with me, but I at least want them to know the perspectives. And again, in issues like terrorism, you need to know what the other side is thinking. Even if you don't like it, know what they're thinking, know what they're doing. And no drone will ever teach you that.
Right. And, you know, the finest or the best weapon you can have in a war is intelligence. You know, if you understand what the enemy is thinking, what their mindset is, that beats a gun every time.
Well, I think Sun Tzu would agree with you. And if we go back several thousand years, the Chinese knew it, and all the great empire builders have known it. And I would suggest that those nations that fell by the wayside and eventually crumbled are those that never learned that. And again, a gun gets you so far, but a gun doesn't necessarily tell you when to shoot or who to shoot if you have to shoot.
You mentioned Sun Tzu. Unfortunately, his book wasn't available on Amazon 2,000 years ago.
No, but it is now. So, again, something worth reading.
Okay, I do have to wrap this up. Eric, I really want to thank you for taking time out to talk to me and my listeners. I wish you every success with your book.
Well, thanks very much, Simon. I appreciate your having me on the program, and I hope that in a couple of years we have occasion, at the very least, to do this again, by which time I'm hoping I have another book.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. Okay, till next time, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy and safe day. Yeah, stay healthy. Don't do anything bad. Don't get into terrorism. Otherwise, my good friend Eric Wintz will probably mention you in his next book. So till next time, goodbye.
All right. Thanks, Simon. Goodbye.